MacCast, Sunday, June 3rd, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's Tom for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. You know, I am in the process of getting ready to go on vacation. It's actually down to crunch time. I don't know why this always happens, but, you know, scheduling or planning any kind of big trip is always fun, to say the least. But I'm looking forward to heading up to the central coast of California, and just we go camping for a week every year. It's our weekly trip, often falls during WWDC, so I'm really glad this year that I will be back in town for WWDC and the MacCast WWDC coverage. But I wanted to get an episode of the MacCast out to you before I left, since we won't have an episode next week, so just be aware of that. And I had done an interview about 2 months ago, and just had not got around to editing it. A great conversation, and I think it's actually even more timely now, since, like, on the last MacCast, we talked a little bit about Siri and some of the complaints about Siri. But in this episode, we are going to dive into a little of the background and the history of Siri, and the reason we can do that is actually the amazing MacCast community. I love our community because I get emails from interesting people all the time. You have interesting careers, interesting things that you do, so I love getting your emails. And this one came about, a guy named Nat Bletter sent me an email and said, hey, you know, I'm doing some different things now, and we're going to get into that in this episode. I'll let you know what Nat is up to at the moment. But he said, you know, in my background, in my history, I actually worked at SRI during the 90s when some of these technologies were being developed. And this was before Nuance came about. This was before Siri became Siri. Nat was working in a division at SRI, the Stanford Research Institute, and was able to see some of this technology evolve. And so I was able to get him on the show. We sat down and we had a conversation about what it was like, the kinds of things that he was into. We get a lot into some of the virtual reality technologies and the augmented reality technologies that have made their way into the iPhone. So it's just fun and interesting to get this kind of history of where our technology comes from and how it evolved, and how maybe at the time we thought things were going to go one way and they ended up going another. So I had a great conversation and I wanted to share that with you this week. And then I will be back after my trip, hopefully rested, ready to go for our WWDC coverage. So I really hope you enjoy this episode. Before we dive into everything though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple of our show sponsors. Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. I've talked to you about Deep Freeze in the past. This is great software. If you're in a situation where you need to put a Mac in a shared environment, so maybe a computer lab, you work for a school, or an office environment, you maybe run a small business and you want to make a Mac available to your customers, maybe as like an internet terminal, something like that. This allows you, Deep Freeze allows you to take your Mac, to set it up before you deploy it into that kind of environment, and then to freeze the configuration, the settings, the operating system, everything in place, but do it in a way where the system doesn't feel locked down to your users. And I think that's a big distinction. There's a lot of software out there that'll just kind of protect everything, and then users get on there and they can't do anything with the system. What is great about Deep Freeze is you can kind of decide the areas and pieces that you want to protect, and you can even have whole unprotected areas. So for things like persistent data storage, or maybe you want your user folder, you want your users to be able to do anything inside their user folder, but you just want to protect the system and the library folders and the applications and things like that, you can separate those things using Deep Freeze, and they make it really simple and easy. So then when your users are on the system, they can do whatever they want. They can download software. You can even let them install stuff. But what'll happen is you reboot that system, and then Deep Freeze takes over, kicks in, and restores that system back to its original frozen state, the place you had it in when you originally set it up and deployed that system. So it can reduce your IT costs. It can make managing those systems much easier. It's great. It integrates with other remote management technologies like Apple Remote Desktop. So if you have an IT department and you manage machines using remote software, It works with that. It also is cross-platform, so you can work with Windows machines and Mac machines. Just really great, interesting stuff, and you should check it out. You can get more information and details over at Phoronix.com, and I want to thank them for their support of the MacCast. Another sponsor I want to thank is Gazelle. You know, if you have old Apple technology, you have an old laptop, a notebook, you have an old iPod or an iPhone, something that you've been sitting around. You know, if you're like me, I have some of these old devices and they kind of go off into a corner and they just sit there. Very often I try and repurpose them and give them to family members, but another great thing you could do is resell them. But that can be a hassle. You go on auction websites, you go on classified listings, and you got to deal with a bunch of stuff. Gazelle takes all of that out of the equation, because the service is you go to their website, gazelle.com, you tell them what you have, what kind of device, answer a couple simple questions about the condition that it's in, the accessories you have. So, you know, do you have the original power adapter, things like that. It'll walk you through the process real simply and easily, and then they make you a cash offer. They tell you what they'll give you for your old technology. And in cases where the item has value, they pay for the shipping. In some cases, they'll even send you a box to send it in. So they really try and make the process as seamless and easy as possible. And what they do is they're a re-commerce service. So they go around, go back, and they, when they receive your item, they will wipe it clean, wipe off any personal data, and then they repurpose it. They resell it and put it back out into service. And that way, it's not ending up in a landfill. It's better for the environment. And it's just a really great service. They make it really easy, and you can get cash for some of your old stuff rather than just having it lie around. So check it out, gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So what do you say we go back in time a little bit? I love getting into the histories of technologies and things like that. And like I said, it's great when I can tap the MacCast community, our audience, and the great knowledge and sort of talents that everybody has. And so here's a little conversation I had with Nat Bletter about SRI and Siri and virtual reality and all kinds of cool stuff. So take a listen. Hey, Nat, how are you doing?
I'm great, Adam. How are you? Thanks
Good.
For having me on the show.
Well, welcome to the MacCast, and I'm glad to be able to finally be talking to you. I know we had one start last week and got interrupted by some frogs. You know, the technical issues of podcasting, right?
Yeah, from Hawaii. You always got to deal with the reality of nature here. Luckily, there was no earthquakes or volcanic eruptions.
Yeah, so it sounded like paradise, though. It might have been some nice ambiance, but I think we like a little quieter stuff on the podcast so we can focus on the conversation. And I should probably... So this came about because a few months back, I guess, probably right around just after the iPhone 4S came out, you know, everybody was talking about Siri and the Siri technology that Apple purchased from a company called SRI. And you had been, well, you're a listener to the show and other podcasts. We were just talking about you actually had been on Ken Ray's show at one point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple years ago on the Tech Nation podcast that he used to do.
And that was related to a band in another part of your life, right? Some virtual reality stuff that I'm sure we're going to be talking about.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And so you had contacted me and said, hey, I was at SRI when some of this technology was being born, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I got to play with it really, really early on.
So I thought it'd be great and to have you come on and kind of talk about some of that history and some of the things that you saw in the early days. So I guess a good place to start, just I haven't even gotten this backstory. So how did you end up at SRI and sort of what you were doing there? That's kind of related to the virtual reality part of your career, right?
Exactly, yeah. When I was in college, I got really interested in virtual reality, which was just sort of coming up in Silicon Valley at the time. And for my summer after my junior year, I went to work at VPL, which is Jaron Lanier's company, and kind of pioneered virtual reality. And they were using Macs even back then. I think we figured out it was a Mac 2FX at the time.
Right.
Then when I finished college, I hopped over to SRI, or Stanford Research Institute, just down the road from Stanford. They had started to do some virtual reality research. They had one of the VPL systems. So they said, well, you know this stuff, you should come in here. And so I joined the... It was called the Sensory Sciences program. And so they had like optics and perception research, and just next door to us was the speech recognition group, which eventually was spun off into Nuance in the later 90s. And back then they were doing, you know, sort of pioneering work in speaker independent speech recognition. And this was a great innovation at the time, and they're doing a lot of using it for making, what was it, the airline reservation. So as I walked up and down the halls, I always heard people testing out, I want to fly from New York to California on, you know, April 20th on United Airlines, and it would think about it for a couple minutes, and it would try to come back at you with some reservations.
So was this like for phone systems, like the systems that we call in on now that have kind of speech recognition stuff built into them?
Yeah. I believe that was the main point of it. I think they used that system because it was kind of like a DARPA test bed for comparing speech recognition systems for different companies. They, you know, they have all those grand challenges now, like driving across the desert in an unmanned vehicle.
Right.
Isn't that
right,
kind of near where you live, and going into space? So back then their grand challenge was just to make airline reservations over the phone. Slightly lesser grand challenge.
Well, but I mean, that for the time, that was a grand challenge. So I was going to ask you, so what time, you mentioned kind of late 90s was when maybe Nuance was spun off, or when you were kind of into this stuff. So, I mean, what time frame are we talking about?
Yeah, I started working there in 92, and I think it was within like a year or two, like in 94, I started using, since I was around it so much, it was 94 that they were spun off from SRI. So sort of around the same time I started, because they were still doing research, even once Nuance was spun off, so they're improving it within SRI. And I thought it would make a great companion to the virtual reality. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're walking around with a helmet on your head and you have these measured, instrumented gloves to figure out where your hands are going, you can use some basic gestures to give commands to the computer, but you can't, like, type in text or there was no menuing system at the time, so it was pretty limited how you could give commands to the computer within these systems.
Right.
But there's so much potential, so I thought the speech recognition would make a great companion for that. So I asked them to give me one of their test systems and just hooked it up with some basic commands to move objects around and change their size and their color and different characters. And after I learned the ins and outs of their system, it worked pretty well.
Huh. So let's talk a little bit about then, the technology at the time. So you're in the virtual reality division, and you're working with stuff. So you mentioned you've got gloves and goggles and things like that. So what was the thought at the time? Well, let's start with the hardware. So what kinds of hardware was driving this stuff? Were Macs even involved at that point, or are you talking a higher end, you know, more proprietary kind of systems?
Yeah, they were. The Macs were definitely involved, and that was one of my early involvements with Macs. And it was kind of funny. It was almost a Rube Goldberg device because it had this Mac desktop computer, I guess probably the most powerful Mac at the time, but it was controlling $200,000 Silicon Graphics workstations for doing the rendering, one for each eye. So it was sort of this like an ant, you know, telling the elephant what to do or something.
Right.
And it had this complicated networking system between the Mac and the Silicon Graphics to, you know, get low lag on the rendering.
Right. So you almost had kind of like a clustered kind of computer setup where you've got these big beefy graphics machines for rendering images for each eye, and then the Mac is, correct me if I'm wrong on this, so then the Mac is kind of working as the controller, sort of the interface to that, you know, getting the instructions and controlling then what goes to the goggles. You were using goggles as an output.
Yep. Yep. That was one of the modalities. You could also look at it directly on the screen. And the Mac was getting all the input from like the 6 degree of freedom positioning systems, like the, you know, little accelerometers we all have in our iPhones and iPads these days. It was like a huge several thousand dollar system then, so it could track which way you were turning and moving forwards and backwards. And the Mac was getting that info and the info on, you know, where your glove was and the position your fingers were in. And then it was running this visual programming language, which is what Jaron Lanier's VPL stood for.
Right.
Do you remember Max, the music programming, visual programming language?
I never really got into that. I was going to ask you, because I was always a web programmer, and not mm-hmm. long after this, probably mid-90s, mm-hmm. and I don't know if this was coming out of the VPL stuff, but I do remember VRML, which was supposed to be like this virtual reality markup language so that you could do 3D virtual reality projections, but within a web browser.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I worked on that, too, later on in my career at SRI. We were trying to help set some of the standards for it,
mm-hmm.
and be able to do geographic visualization in it. But no, VRML didn't exist quite yet at that point. So, and that was more just like a markup language, like HTML. It didn't really have much capability for programming.
Yeah, it wasn't meant to be. It wasn't meant to be full featured. It was sort of this way to get virtual reality objects on the web, and it's never really kind of taken off. I think we have the new thing that's coming up now with HTML5 is WebGL, if I'm not mistaken, is kind of supposed to be the next thing. But we've never really had 3D in a browser has always been kind of a tricky thing. You always need some sort of plug-in or add-on or something like that to make it.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Happen. Or that's true. Anything that was really and see because I'm going to get emails now because I said that. VRML, there are technologies built in the web browser. You can do 3D stuff, WebGL, VRML, all this stuff, but nothing's ever really kind of taken off, right?
Nope. Not that I know.
So, I mean,
it always had limitations.
Yeah. So that was kind of what I was going to get to next. So so you're going through these challenges of sort of this interface problem, right? You have the goggles mm-hmm. and you have the gloves and, my impressions are just all the stuff that you see in the movies, right? And there was a lot of stuff mm-hmm. going on in the movies at the time. You had, Max Headroom and Lawnmower Man and, all these sort of funky things. And so our vision was always, or even like Hackers, I think, has some, that came much later, but has some weird.
Just working. Please don't mention Existence.
What?
You remember that really cheesy movie, Existence?
I never saw that movie, no.
It had a lot of virtual reality.
Am I losing geek cred on that one? But the point was, is you mentioned talking to SRI, and I never really thought about that, about integrating sort of the voice technologies for that control, because what you always saw in the movies was you'd have the gloves and you'd tap some sort of virtual control, and then up would pop a virtual keyboard that you would type on, or there'd be some sort of buttons that would come up in an interface or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Within the virtual reality at the time, there was nothing like that. That's why the speech recognition was such a great addition. Yeah, it was just the visual programming language didn't really have a built-in system like doing menus or even for doing text very well
right.
at the time. But that would have definitely helped it a lot and tried to hack together some things to do that. There's also a severe limit on like the number of polygons you could render at the time. So doing a menuing system with text might have been kind of difficult.
Right. So at the time, what was it like? I mean, so you got this test system, you're marrying it with the virtual reality stuff. How how does it compare to what we have now? You know, how limited was it, and what kinds of things could you do with it? I mean, you mentioned that it was, you know, they had done this airline sort of system, but we're talking mid 90s here. So,
right.
What was
it like? At first, I tried to throw everything at it. Like, I tried to get the speech recognition system to, you know, handle all the modeling of objects and their physical characteristics, and I wanted it to do, like, act as a calculator and do, like, everything, sort of be the kitchen sink. Mm-hmm. But since it was speaker independent, to still give it some guide of what you might say, you had to have a grammar that would give the computer some idea of what possible things you might say to look for in this greater, this huge space, to narrow it down quicker. So I threw such a huge grammar at it that it just took, you know, maybe 10 minutes to recognize even a basic phrase. So that was really not usable.
But it could do it at the time. There just wasn't enough processing power to kind of have it happen in a real time fashion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, you had the Mac doing the like sort of master command, then two SGIs doing the rendering, another computer doing 3D sound, and then a Sun workstation doing the speech recognition. So if you think about all of that now, it's compressed into this tiny little iPhone in your pocket, and the iPhone is much better at it all. And that combination of five or six computers, it's kind of hilarious.
Yeah,
good proof of Moore's Law.
Yeah, it shows how fast and quickly technology comes and becomes viable. So, I mean, at the time, though, do you remember what challenges or what things they were trying to do with this technology, or what they thought the technology would be used for? And is it ending up, now that we have it in our iPhones, is this kind of the vision of the engineers at the time, or was it something completely different?
I think it was kind of waiting for its killer application, mm-hmm. in many ways. And I was hoping, you know, virtual reality might be one of the killer applications. I think virtual reality needed its own killer application too. That's why it never really took off. No one really figured out what the best thing to do with it besides gaming was. But when I started using the speech recognition for just sort of basic modeling and characteristics of the objects in the world, it really worked well, and it became much more fluid. You could just say, okay, put this object over here, and you could point at an object with your hand as you're saying things, and it would sort of keep track of where you're pointing at the times of each word in the speech, and you could change their colors. And it gave me a really funny experience, because usually I don't like to take my work home with me, but after working with the goggles all day and ordering objects around, when I'd go home at night, I'd like see my car a block away, and I'd point it and I'd say, bring my car here. And I'm like, oh, wait, I'm not at work anymore. That doesn't work if I'm not in the head-mounted display.
Well, it's kind of like having the Force at that point, right?
Yes, exactly.
If you could just translate to this to the real world other than the virtual world. But that kind of gives me a sense of the kinds of things that you were kind of working with, though. You know, the fact that you could give voice commands pointing to an object, affect its properties, say, you know, make this larger by 30% or move that, mm-hmm. over there, you know, those sorts of things. Now, you were mentioning earlier, you thought that, you know, maybe this would be kind of a killer app, or there'd be kind of some killer apps for virtual reality. I'm curious to get your take on why you think, because as I was saying earlier, virtual reality kind of has never really taken off in any big fashion outside of some specific industries. I would assume, you know, there's instances where the military and certain kinds of medical applications and things like that. But do you have a sense of why? Because again, science fiction tells us these are all things that we want to have, right? And right, we want flying cars, and we want you know, holodecks, and we want pads. And I guess we have pads now to a certain degree, right?
Yeah, I think it was a combination of many things that it never took off. One was the what's the word I'm looking for? Not accuracy, but how true to life it was.
Mm-hmm. The realism. It's just not.
Yeah.
You know, you have limits in terms of what you can do with polygons and things like that. Although those lines are blurring. I mean, you look at what the new iPad is capable of in terms of graphics and what we're seeing in movies and things like that. But there's still that. You never reach that suspension of disbelief, I guess is how you would put it, right? There's always that layer of I can tell this is digital and not 100% real.
Right. Yeah. So I think that was a big part of it, because the Killer app could have been a lot of these medical applications that you mentioned.
Right.
And some people in another department at SRI were working on telepresence surgery, so that like a surgeon, you know, way back from the front line of a battle could operate on a soldier who's right on the front line immediately. And it had like force feedback and everything, so the remote surgeon could feel what was happening at a distance. And that seemed like a really great application. That's more like augmented reality or telepresence than virtual reality. But I think a lot of medical applications would have been great, but just the authenticity of it was so low at the time that it never really got to the level that application would need. There were a lot of games that we were testing. A lot of game makers, I won't mention any names, but they wanted us to be like the good housekeeping of virtual reality. So they'd come to us and say, hey, we have this great head-mounted display. Can you test it and make sure that it won't make all the, you know, 12-year-olds who play these games 8 hours a day, you know,
sick,
brain damaged or something? And we tested them, and they made a lot of people nauseous, like 10% of people nauseous. So we said, well, yeah, I don't think you can really release something that's going to mess with someone's developing visual system.
And, yeah, that probably wouldn't be a very good thing.
Yeah. And we said, but there's a couple things you could do to change the way you design the game that would make it a lot better. You know, it's like when you're in a car or a plane and your balance system in your ear tells you that you're moving one way, but what you see, your eyes tell you that you're moving another way. That's what gets you sick.
Right.
Or like when you're on a boat. So they were doing everything possible to make you sick by letting you change your point of view just with the game controller. And we said, oh, if you just change this, it'll probably be a lot better. And like, no, we just want your seal of approval. Forget it. We're going to can the whole program. So they weren't really, a lot of the game companies didn't seem like they were willing to work on the game design. So that was another issue. I really felt like 3D modeling was going to be the killer app of virtual reality, because,
right,
you know, when you're trying to do all this 3D modeling that's done for movies and games now, and you have to do it all on a 2D screen, it's often hard to get a good viewpoint to see how things are lining up. And so the virtual reality, or at least the stereo displays, would be perfect for that.
Yeah. Well, virtual reality could be great, because you could almost, like, you know, especially now, you're building virtual sets in a lot of cases. So to be able to walk around and, like, really pick up materials and put them into place and, you know, assemble them together. And that was a problem I've always had with 3D modeling, is that I could never get past that sort of point of putting myself in that space and really understanding where things were. Or, you know, sculpting, the ability to sculpt objects the same way a sculptor would, by moving around it, by moving in and out from it and things like that. Yeah, that I mean, mm-hmm. it seems like an ideal application for that sort of technology.
Yeah, and I saw some examples of it. I don't know. But again, the fidelity, that's the word I was looking for. Fidelity just never got to where it needed to be.
Yeah.
Instead of all this virtual reality stuff, it seemed like the augmented reality was really where the stuff could really shine. And, you know, that has now reappeared in the iPhone too, with all these apps like Yelp that let you hold it up and see where all the nearest shops are, or looking for subways in New York. And that was something that sort of in the mid-90s we had thought would be a great application. We started designing these little LCD TVs that you could hold up and sort of get a window on the world with, you know, augmented information. and we thought it would be great for travel too, like, you know, get directions in augmented reality and 3D. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that has now come to pass too. So I guess that's where a lot of the effort and ideas in virtual reality got channeled instead of the virtual, it became augmented.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit then, the tube. I mean, because don't you think a lot of the stuff that we're seeing now, though, and I've played around with some of those apps and things like that, it all just seems, again, a little bit gimmicky in how it's applied. It's like this cool thing, and it's fun to show off. It makes, you know, I always talk about these technologies that I call make great demo. You know, it's like the thing that you can sell an iPhone with. You're like, look, you can do this. It's really cool. But when it comes down to practically applying it and like, do I use that feature on most of those applications most of the time that I use those apps? And for me, the answer is generally no. I don't know if you've had a similar experience.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I played with augmented like store finder, restaurant finder stuff on the iPhone a little bit, but I don't use it on a regular basis at all. Like driving directions, it's, you know, it gives it to you in 3D, kind of in the direction you're moving, but it's not integrating the camera data,
right,
that you're seeing. So it's not really doing it as a heads-up display.
Yeah, don't you think that's kind of maybe one of the hang-ups, is sort of we're trying to create this heads-up display, which is, hey, hold your iPad or your iPhone in front of your face. But what you really need, you do kind of almost need it to be one of these technologies where the technology disappears. I think that's the key in a lot of cases for a lot of the stuff that Apple is trying to do in terms of ease of use and simplicity and stuff like that. And I've always described it as technology getting out of your way. And it's one of the reasons why I'm a Mac user. I worked on Windows boxes for 5 or 6 years doing, you know, PC, Windows programming, Microsoft, Visual Studio and .NET and all that, or C#.NET. And so working on a PC, what was always frustrating to me was a lot of the times the technology, the computer, was the thing I was having to wrestle with, and it was kind of getting in the way of me actually doing my programming or my work. And I'm an Apple fan because the computer kind of gets out of the way, and the software gets out of the way, and it lets me just focus on tasks. Mm-hmm. And with technologies like the augmented reality, it you sort of don't have that experience. It's, you still have that plane in front of you. And I think that's kind of what you were talking about when we were talking about why some of the virtual reality technologies haven't taken off, because you don't have that realism. You don't have that sense of presence. You don't have that, you know, the technology is still there. It's another reason why I think 3D movies and this whole trend about 3D stuff is really annoying to me, because once again, there's this sort of layer between me, these glasses that sit between me and the actual 3D experience, shift the colors. They make everything off a little bit. So yeah, you're getting 3D and it's kind of cool. It's a cool effect and I enjoy it from time to time, but it's really not, you're aware that, hey, I'm watching a 3D movie and these glasses are here getting in the way, or hey, I'm in a virtual reality experience, but I know this isn't really real. This is just, you know, a fake thing being put up by the computer. And I think to a certain degree, the augmented reality stuff still hasn't gotten there yet, because I would want, you know, something that it's, hey, it's just there in front of my eyes. When I look over there, oh, there's the information. Or if I look over there, there's the information. I'm not having to pull this other device, this other screen, and kind of hold it up and act as a window, you know, just like you're looking through a window or something like that. I mean, it's cool, but yeah, I think that's why maybe it hasn't taken off.
So you're saying you're not going to buy it until they come out with the holodeck?
Well, I don't know. Well, so to bring it all back to what we're talking about with SRI and Nuance and Siri, I think why Siri's getting so much attention right now is because, once again, to me, Apple has made that almost disappear. And you get in this really odd situation where you're like using Siri and Siri almost becomes this assistant, right? It's just like, you just, there she is. Hey, can you do this for me? Yeah, I'll do that for you. Even though the technology is there in your mind for some reason, the way it's implemented and how easy it is to use, it kind of blends into the background. And I think like the text-to-speech stuff has taken a really long time. And look what we're talking about with Siri and Nuance, they were working on this stuff in the 90s, probably in the late 80s and even further back, right? This has been in progression for years and years. But it's not until just recently that it's sort of become ubiquitous enough that people are starting to get comfortable using it. And I'm still not 100% comfortable like using Siri and giving voice commands. Like I was doing it, it was funny because I took this trip up to the mountains this weekend and I wanted to reply to some emails and I only took my iPad with me. And I have the new iPad that has the dictation. And I was kind of typing out these responses. And I can use the virtual keyboard. I've gotten pretty good at it. But it's still pretty slow compared to if I had brought my Bluetooth keyboard with me, say. And so I thought, you know, I'll use this dictation thing. And it worked awesome. I mean, it was incredible how accurate it was, how quickly I could respond things out. But there were other people in the in this cabin with me. And they're like, what are you doing? Are you talking to me? Or no, I'm just... you know, replying to these emails. So you kind of had to tell everybody, you know, they thought you were talking to yourself or going crazy or something like that. So you still have that kind of social dilemma.
Yeah, I think that's the last frontier. That's the last frontier of the technology disappearing is if you could maybe just like move your mouth and it could somehow detect what words you were trying to say instead of you actually having to say it. Because, yeah, definitely the people walking with the Bluetooth headset looking like Data down the street is still a little too freaky, or people talking, looking like they're talking to themselves. So.
But I think the natural language, and you alluded to this a little bit before, because you said, you know, at the time, one of the limitations of the technology was you sort of had to have this language set, right? This set of commands that you could tell the computer, okay, you're going to recognize these phrases said in kind of this order. And we've had that kind of voice control for a really long time, but I think... you know, what's really been the amazing part of Siri is the natural language processing. And it's still not perfect, but it's pretty amazing the amount of stuff that can be understood and processed, and more importantly, how quickly. Because I think you pointed out earlier, you know, the fact that you could give it these great commands, but it would take so long to process. And that's not a really natural experience.
No.
That's not how we talk to people. So... that was the other amazing thing that impressed me about the voice dictation was I was on a pretty, you know, bad internet connection, but I could, you know, hit the dictation and within less than a second, I mean, it would process whole paragraphs of information. Right. I don't know if they're streaming outwards or how they're getting it out to the Nuance servers to get it back that quickly, but yeah, it's been really impressive to me.
Did you have a 4G connection up there? Or supposedly 4G? Whatever.
No, I was actually on my Wi-Fi iPad, and I was using my Virgin mobile phone as a hotspot, and the connection was horrible. I mean, surfing the web was just like, it was like edge speed is what it felt like. So
it is impressive. I was able to do it at that. How many gadgets did you have to involve in this whole procedure? Just two?
Just two.
Okay.
Just do, and it's only the hotspot because it's I get unlimited data connection on it for $25 a month.
So. Ah, gotcha. You didn't need to involve the iPhone in that. No.
Yeah, if I had been responding on my iPhone, I could have just used the iPhone, and that would have been the only technology. So.
Right. But how much can you use aside from the dictation? Like, I have to admit, I don't have a 4S. I have a 4. So I try to use the voice dialing on it all the time, and I don't know how much more accurate the iPhone 4S is with that, with Siri, with simple things like that. But I often get really frustrated. I try to use it, you know, when I'm driving. I don't want to look at the phone.
Right.
But when I say, you know, call David so-and-so, it then proceeds to list off the 10 Jeffs that I know instead of
I don't know if the 4S is better at that stuff or not. It seems like it is to me because I played around with it on the 4 as well, you know, the voice commands, and they never really seemed to work that well. But I would have thought that would have been more of a software issue than necessarily a hardware issue. But I do think I'd have to look this up, I don't have it in front of me. I do think there's something about the microphones that are in the 4S that are a little better at, and the chip itself. I think the the audio processing chip that's in the 4S has some additional technologies in the hardware that helps with the noise filtering. And I think that's the main problem in it understanding commands, is that I've noticed if you're in a really, like with the 4, if I was in a really quiet environment, it would work almost 100% of the time. But if I was in my car driving and the radio was on, there was any kind of extra noise in the space, that's when it would kind of tend to get things a little off.
Gotcha.
I don't know if you noticed the same kind of behavior.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All the, like, wind is terrible, which is kind of all the time when you're outside in Hawaii.
And the 4S doesn't seem to have those problems. I've been in some amazingly noisy environments and doing demos for people, you know, like at a party or a bar or something like that, and just using the built-in mic, and it's done, you know, pretty well, you know, 90% accuracy. And I would never try that with the 4 because it just wouldn't work. So, yeah.
And do you use the voice dialing on your 4S
I don't use the voice dialing. I use text messaging a lot. And I'm starting to use the music controls a lot more. I'm starting to get more comfortable with it. I think that's another part of this sort of acceptance of technology, right? It's we get the technology, but until it's out and in mass use, like you said, the killer application where it goes sort of mainstream, then you just don't really use it all that much. It's still that gimmicky phase.
Yeah, I think with the augmented reality and the speech recognition, I think if they could maybe come together in some sort of travel app where, have you seen the Microsoft technology, the PhotoSynth?
Yeah.
Where it lets you take random pictures and it stitches them all together. If they could sort of integrate that technology so, you have your vague location from GPS, but maybe using what the camera is seeing and what it knows to be the 3D makeup of your surroundings, it can sort of very, very accurately pinpoint your location and, you know, within Times Square to a couple feet, and then it can overlay, go down this street with an arrow to get to where you want to be. And if you could, have the speech recognition to control it, so you can hold it up at the same time as you're giving it commands, that could really open it up. But for that to happen, they have to open up Siri, with the API, so that third-party developers can use it. And I think that will create an explosion in its use, just like the App Store did.
Yeah, I half wonder why that hasn't happened yet. If there's a licensing holdback or something like that, I think Apple intends at some point to open up Siri APIs. Maybe it's just because they're still in quote unquote beta. Although that's true. The other thing I have to keep reminding myself is that Siri is supposedly beta, but it's amazingly good and accurate for being beta. So that's actually a good thing to kind of jump back. So we kind of leapt forward with the virtual reality stuff, but I want to maybe finish up a little bit more on the Siri side and the evolution of that technology. So you were there when SRI kind of spun off that technology to Nuance. So did you know people that then ended up at Nuance, and how long did you maintain those relationships if you had them? And what do you know about that whole period of time?
Yeah, they were actually, they're now in Massachusetts, I believe, but they were still next to SRI in Menlo Park for a couple of years at least while I was there. So, and I think there was still some, like, they still had the speech recognition program there, and so they were continuing to do R&D, and then it would get transferred to Nuance. So I was still interacting with them a bit. But about the time that Nuance was spun off, I moved into the Artificial Intelligence Center and started working on sort of geographic visualization stuff, like what Google Earth has become now. And that's actually why I got in touch with you, because you had thought that Nuance was used a lot more of this artificial intelligence technology.
Right.
But it... That is artificial intelligence is kind of the future and may always be the future.
Why do you say that?
Oh, it's another thing like virtual reality where they made all these amazing promises in the, 1970 that within 10 years we're going to have, natural language understanding and image recognition. And we're getting a lot of pieces of it here and there. You can do like a Google image search now by giving it an image and a lot of the natural language that you see in Siri, but it's definitely not moving as fast as they had promised.
So the natural language stuff that's in Siri, I guess that's right. We kind of connected at that level. So what it seems like to me, or what it seemed like to me, was that there was some AI going on behind the scenes with Siri, that it's really doing this natural language stuff. But maybe it's more like an Oz kind of thing at this point, where it's behind the scenes, they're just doing some smart things to kind of understand what I'm saying. But and the more I use it, the more I'm kind of seeing that's what's going on. Because where the places where Siri falls down are those points when it's predicting keywords, like it knows certain keywords and then tries to respond contextually based on those keys, right? And a good example of this is a command that I've always had a hard time giving it is, how far is it to the sun? Wanting it to give me the Wolfram Alpha data for the distance from the Earth to the sun. It always
thinks it's talking about your child.
No. It always thinks that I want to know the directions to like Sun City or some town that's near me. It either tries to give me directions or it tries to schedule a meeting or something for Sunday.
Got it.
See what I'm saying? So that's where the curtain kind of falls down and you go, oh, well, maybe it's not really, being that smart about its natural language processing, but you can say, how far is it to the moon? And it has no problem. Cause I guess maybe, maybe I don't have a problem. Maybe if I live close to Half Moon Bay, it would try to give me directions to Half Moon Bay, but
yeah, it's just trying to give you more practical information. It's like, why the hell would you want to go to the sun? You must be trying to get to Sun City.
You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, is that kind of what you're talking about? Like, we had all these big promises of AI, and a lot of the stuff that we see now that people call AI is really this sort of pseudo artificial intelligence at this point.
No, I think now Siri definitely incorporates a lot of aspects of artificial intelligence. To be able to have this like context that, when you give it one command and then you refer back to it in the next command without reiterating everything, a lot of that is the natural language part of it. But until you have, these projects where they try to integrate, they try to teach the computer like basic facts and connections over a long time by like reading it newspapers every day and having it ask questions about how is the sun in the sky different from Sun City, California,
right?
That it can finally incorporate this much larger natural language base. I don't know, did we ever fully understand what the data center in North Carolina that Apple set up is for? Is it for some parts of it for Siri and some parts of it for iCloud, or is it all iCloud? Is that ever revealed?
No. I think it's maybe an R&D center for the Ion engine that they're going to put into the new spaceship center so that they can leave Earth and go to another
take off from
planet.
Cupertino.
It's a black box. No, I'm sure a lot of the iCloud technologies, a lot of the Siri technologies and stuff are centered there. I don't know if anybody knows absolutely for sure, though.
Okay. I mean, that might partially have something to do with it, like who's running the servers that is running Siri, because I think a lot of it is actually still run by Nuance, at least for the dictation part.
Right.
I should say that it gets sent to their servers and then they send it back. So that might put some limit on, how much natural language stuff they can integrate. And it also might have something to do with why they haven't opened it up to third-party developers as well, because that's going to hugely increase the amount of network traffic. And Nuance might not be set up for that yet. So unless they can move it to one of Apple's own data centers.
Yeah.
So I could handle that capacity.
I think the last thing that I kind of want to get your take on, and this can either be just on based on stuff you read, or maybe you actually have some personal experience with this. I know one of the next kind of technologies that a lot of people are predicting is going to find their way into iPhones and iPads, touch devices, is some sort of smarter, better haptic feedback system. Did you ever play around with any of those kinds of technologies? I'm assuming maybe force feedback, but anything more sophisticated than that at the time?
Yeah, there wasn't much except that telepresence surgery that I mentioned. And that was pretty amazing when I used it, that you could feel things that were not right there. Mm-hmm. And you were sort of working through like an instrument handle that you're holding, but you could sort of feel different surfaces. And there's been all those Apple patents about that, I believe.
Yeah, supposedly the company that's behind this technology was exhibiting some stuff. A friend of mine told me he was exhibiting some stuff at CES, and he got to play around with a device, you know, a demo device they had there. And reportedly, you know, rather than just being the sort of you touch here and it buzzes gimmicky stuff that, you know, I'm used to on some of the, like my Android phone has haptic feedback, you know, if you can really call it that. To me, you move your finger over a button, the whole thing vibrates. Okay, great. You know, it just I touch something, it vibrates. That doesn't seem all that amazing to me. But reportedly, this technology actually relies on a whole kind of separate layer of the surface, and it will actually react in turn in that layer, I guess, with some sort of charge or something like that. And supposedly you can feel textures, you know, down to the point where you can tell, oh, this is smooth, this is rough, and it's highly localized.
Was that the Finnish or Swedish company?
I think so, yeah. The Swedish company, exactly.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, that looks super interesting, and I hope that will show up soon. I go to Sweden once a year now to teach a chocolate making class, so maybe I can go drop in on them and try it out and check on their progress.
Technology. But yeah, I mean, I think that's another one of those things that goes a long way to sort of blurring those lines of, you know, now we can have buttons, or even like in games, we can actually have surfaces on a touch game now that you're moving across, and oh, here's the road surface here when you're driving your car, and there's the off-road surfaces, and those are bumpy and have a different texture at that point on the screen, and that's just unbelievable, you know. So you're feeling something that's actually not there. Right. And so I, you know, that interests me in a lot of ways. And you know, again, the augmented reality stuff too. I think you're right. Given the right application, if you can get to that point where you can create this suspension of disbelief, or just that the technology blurs away and you're just interacting with the information or whatever, you know, content you're trying to get at, I think that's where these technologies kind of really start to take off.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when you bring together multiple senses, it's really going to be great. And being in the business of chocolate, I'm waiting for them to do the taste feedback so people can know what our chocolate tastes like remotely.
And not the April Fool's joke like the newscaster here in San Diego did.
What did they say?
Yeah, I don't know if you saw that video. There was last April, not this year, there was a newscaster here who said there was a new tasting app for the iPhone, and he got his coworker on camera to actually lick her iPhone.
Okay. Yeah, I did hear about that.
But no, that technology doesn't exist. Well, I mean, that's great. Yeah, let's finish up. So, you know, so your background in all this technology, you obviously have I'm assuming some sort of engineering degree or something like that.
Yep. I sort of designed my own major in engineering and what did I call it? Can't even remember. Visual computing or something like
visual,
that.
Visual computing. So that's your background. But after you contacted me, you said, "Hey, I make chocolates," and you did a Kickstarter project, and you now have a chocolate company, and you're in Hawaii, and your life is kind of a lot different than and further away from this technology to a certain degree. But it sounds like you're also using some of the technology in what you do now, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So the company is called Madre Chocolate, and make chocolate from Hawaiian cacao and Mexican cacao and try to reconnect people with where chocolate came from. Because in between working in Silicon Valley and now I did a PhD in ethnobotany, sort of like the cross of anthropology and botany, learning how people interact with plants. I use a lot of my engineering background and sort of throwing up equations on the screen when I did presentations to botanists to make them run screaming out of the room in fear. But then, no, I'm definitely using a lot of it even now. I mean, we use an iPad running Square for all of our, you know, instead of a cash register, it's much easier. And we do farmers markets. We're doing the same thing on our iPhones. And we even have some remote, maybe you could even call it augmented chocolate making, where we can turn on and off our chocolate grinders and heaters remotely through a power controller that I can just access through the iPhone. So, you know, like if the power goes out in the shop and we don't want to drive over there, we can just flip a few switches on the phone and it will make sure that it doesn't come on in a bad state and break the machines. Or if we decide that, you know, it's done at 2 a.m., we can just tell the machine to turn off right then. So
you can actually kind of control and monitor some of the things that are going on in the chocolate making facility from your iPhone.
Yes.
So exactly. What specific technology are you using to do that?
We have a what was the power controller? I'm trying to remember. I think it's just called
not the X10 power stuff, right? It's something.
No, it's this little, it's like a power strip and you just hook it up to an Ethernet port and it will let you turn on and off each of the individual power strips on there.
Oh, each one of the individual plugs. That's cool.
Yeah. And it has even a little scripting language so you can say, like, if the power has been off for an hour since you were last aware of it, you know, don't reinitiate it in the same state. Don't turn the machines back on because if that happened, like the liquid chocolate would solidify in the machine, and then if the motor tried to turn back on, it was no way it could grind it, and it would burn itself out quickly and potentially even start a fire. So we have to put some intelligence in there, especially in Hawaii, where we have power outages quite often,
quite frequently. And then on the iPhone, then how do you control that? Is there like a web interface, or is there a special app? Or?
Yeah, it's just a simple web interface.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and then I live on the Big Island, and our shop is on Oahu, so I have to do a lot of other stuff remotely, sort of managing all our finances and what's going on in the shop, and I'm working with all the cacao farmers over here, and we're trying to integrate some technology into the way the cacao is fermented to really make it the best possible cacao in the world. So yeah, definitely I and my business partner, who is a big Linux geek, we like to, even though we're doing very traditional style chocolate, we like to throw a lot of this technology at it behind the scenes.
That's kind of amazing. Well, cool. I want to thank you for chatting with us and giving us a little history and background on some of the Siri SRI stuff and
all
this virtual reality. And it's fun to see where technology is going and stuff like that. And then all the way through the chocolate business. I'm amazed at sort of how people's careers progress with technology and especially Apple products, of course, and stuff like that. So it was great to be able to get to chat with you for a little bit. To finish up, I think maybe can you just tell people about the Kickstarter project and where they can go to find out more about your chocolate business and kind of what you're doing now? Because I do think that's really interesting. And I know you have some videos up there and I'm amazed by Kickstarter too. I think Kickstarter's been one of those things that's brought us a lot of different products, you know, technology and obviously non-technology related, because you wouldn't have a chocolate company. Well, would you have a chocolate company without Kickstarter?
You think? We would, but we'd probably be like struggling to get by. It really helped us get
up and
off the ground. Yeah. And we're still So the Kickstarter project, which we did, we started in June and went through August of 2011, and it was to get funding to bring a half ton of cacao from Chiapas, Mexico, very close to where chocolate was invented, into the States so we could turn it into chocolate and really reintroduce people to where chocolate came from, because right now you can't find maybe one or two chocolates that are made from Mexican cacao, which is a bit of a travesty given that right. It's its birthplace.
Yeah, so the point was to kind of bring it really back to its roots and really understand, like you're saying, with the ethnobotany, you know, really trying to understand the people's relationships to the plants and then to the product and stuff like that. So, you know, that's why I thought it was really, really very interesting. So, the Kickstarter, do you have a URL for the Kickstarter page? Or
oh, if you just go to our to madrechocolate.com, M-A-D-R-E, like mother, it's on there, and there's a video and explains it. And we, the whole time we were traveling through Oaxaca and Chiapas, we took videos on our phones to sort of report back to all our backers on how everything was going. And actually just today we finally got news that the cacao is making its way across the U.S. border in Laredo, Texas. So that's pretty exciting. Six months later, finally getting it.
This is not an easy process, right? I mean, you guys are doing something that has been done for a long time. So yeah. That's great. That's awesome.
But yeah, the Kickstarter was a great thing. It was a huge amount of work, and you know, this was before the era of what is it, like $1 million a day that they're doing for one project on Kickstarter now.
Right. Yeah, they've had that new retro game project that took off, and you know, at Macworld it was amazing. I mean, at Macworld there are so many accessory companies that kind of got their start through Kickstarter. And really kicked up, and we're getting some amazing products because of it. So I think it's a cool thing. I also did kind of find out there is a little bit of a dark side though to it as well, because there's a lot of projects that you know, maybe get funded and then the people don't realize, you know, how much of a business that they're getting into, and funding falls short and products don't get delivered and stuff like that. So I know it's like a challenge on that side of things.
Oh yeah, like with Groupon or something where you get more than you can handle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Or you're going into a business you've never been in before. You're using Kickstarter to kick it off and you just don't understand that business. So you think something's going to take $15,000 and it really takes $30,000. Right. So you get the 15, you get funded, and then you realize you can't reach the finish line. So then what do you do?
But I think it's been a great boon. And we always say we were looking around on there on what was successful at the time. And it seemed like if you had something on a popsicle stick and you were based in either Portland, Oregon or Brooklyn, mm-hmm. you would get featured instantly and your project would get funding right away. So,
oh, you're talking about like the popsicle stick puppet kind of diagram things that people do.
No, it just seemed like all these like some food on a popsicle stick, and you would get featured on the front page.
Food on a stick was very popular over at Kickstarter.
Yes, exactly. Now it seems like iPod docs, right?
Yeah. So, or styluses.
Yes, exactly.
Well, cool. Nat, I want to thank you for chatting with us for a little bit, and good luck with everything. And, you know, everybody go check out the Madre Chocolates.
Thank you, Adam. It was great to talk to you after I listened to you for many, many years, and always loving your show. So let me know if you ever have any other questions about the dark days of virtual reality back in the 90s.
Cool. Maybe when Apple brings out their virtual reality goggles, we'll chat again.
Okay. Sounds perfect.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Take care, Adam. Thank you.
That was Nat Bletter talking about the early days of Siri and SRI, and also his chocolate company. Great guy. Had a fun time hanging out and just chatting with him, both what the conversation you heard, and we had some conversations off mic as well. Just really great stuff. And, you know, maybe we'll be able to get him back on at some point to talk about some of the other things that he's up to. I really like to know a little bit more about how he's integrating technology into his company, or maybe you're integrating Apple technologies into a business venture that you have going. Send me an email. I'd love to hear about that sort of stuff. But I also got lucky because Nat sent me some of his chocolate, which is delicious. So at the very least, you should go check out the Madre Chocolate website. I got the pink peppercorn and smoked salt dark chocolate. Really good stuff. Nice little heat to it and great flavor and stuff like that. So I guess when you start with the right starting ingredients and really know your product, it really shines through. So I guess in a lot of ways, like how Apple puts a lot of attention to detail, sounds like Nat's doing a very similar thing with the chocolates, and it shows. So check that out, madrechocolate.com. As I said at the top of the show, I am off on vacation. I'm going to be camping for a week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram and all those typical places if you want to see what I'm up to, but there's not going to be a MacCast next week. I'll be back the following week with WWDC coverage, and it should be a lot of fun. Apple's going to drop a big technology bomb, I think, on us, because we're hearing about operating system, new iOS devices, new maybe a new Apple TV, a true Apple TV, and a bunch of Mac hardware, hopefully. A lot of us are looking forward to that. I really hope that they do something with the Mac Pro line, although I have a feeling it's going to be mostly about laptops and probably a new 15-inch MacBook Pro, but that's just my gut instinct at this point. It'd be nice if they just slid out a Mac Pro sort of silently in the background, a nice little bump up for you Pro users out there. It could happen, and I think it's very likely to happen, but we have to wait and see. You know, we don't know until Apple actually gets up there and tells us what they're up to. So it's always fun to get an update from Apple, and we will be covering that in full. And just like this episode, you know, the MacCast is such a great community. I do want to hear from you. So if you have comments, you have questions, you have suggestions, please send me email. MacCast@gmail.com. You can attach an audio file, an MP3. I love getting audio comments. If you don't want to go through the hassle of having to fire up GarageBand or something like that, you can just call in on the listener hotline. There's a voicemail, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can also leave voicemails on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And be sure to check out the website at maccast.com. There you can get show notes and links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, and check out the MacCast forum. That's a great online community. We just did a software upgrade on the forum software, and I really like a lot of the new UI elements. I think it's become even easier to use, and it's just a great community hanging out there. So check that out, forum.maccast.com. Like I said, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.